You're listening live to Right Side Radio with Phil Williams. It's hard to go wrong when you're on the right side. Right Side Radio, solid, conservative, and just plain right.
Alabama's syndicated news talk leader, Right Side Radio. Phil Williams here live in the Right Side studios. Man, we got the local, the state, the national, and yeah, today, international. And we're going to cover down on all the issues like the dude just said, solid, conservative, and just plain right. Well, welcome to Monday. It's Monday all day long, but darn, it's a pretty Monday. But man, Boomer, the temperature went up.
Oh, man, it did go up. Hot. It is hot.
Apparently, it's Alabama summer again.
There we go. Just, you know, like you said, wait a couple minutes or a couple days, and it's going to change.
I'm saying. Well, how was your weekend?
It was good. Yours?
How's your back?
My back is working. It is working well.
You can bend over and pick things up now?
I can. Oh. It's doing good. Good. I'm happy, so thank you.
All right. Good. We're glad. All right. A happy boomer makes for a happy show. That's the way we like to say it around here.
No.
All right. Hey, guys. Welcome to Monday. We got a great show laid on for you. So we're going to be talking a lot about this stuff going on in Russia right now, which I'll get into in more details in a minute. But at 3 o'clock today, somebody who's been on the show a couple of times has become a friend of Right Side Radio, Major General Joe Arbuckle, who spent the last half of his nearly 30-year career doing strategic-level planning. We're going to have him on to discuss some of his thoughts regarding what is happening with Russia, the Wagner Group, the war in Ukraine, all of it. So, yeah, there's that coming up at 3 p.m. Then at 3:30 p.m., Todd Stacey is the owner and chief editor at Alabama Daily News. Alabama Daily News got hold of the maps being proposed right now for the redistricting of Alabama's congressional lines. So I texted Todd Stacey yesterday. I said, hey, man, you got time to come on and talk about this? Because, yeah, it's if they go with the lines that are being currently proposed by the plaintiffs in that case, it's going to be a complete redraw. I mean, like a complete redraw. So we'll see what Todd Stacey has to say. By the way, he used to work for Congresswoman Roby. And I suspect he's got some thoughts. And then there's a whole triple dipper, so hit it.
The triple dipper. Three stories you've got to know.
That's right, the triple dipper. Three stories, three themes, if you will, that you got to know as we run today's show. So first out the gate, Russian roulette. I don't know if y'all were tracking this past weekend, but one of the more bizarre scenes in world events in my lifetime happened this past weekend. And oh, by the way, it happened in a nuclear country, as a mercenary army of 25,000 or more with tanks, armored vehicles, and everything it takes to support them with log trains started rolling towards Moscow. It was a crazy situation, and I don't think we're done yet. There's more left to unfold. News is breaking right now that Putin is expected to give a statement to the press anytime now, and we'll keep you updated. But number one in the triple dipper, Russian roulette, that's what I'm calling it. So y'all stay tuned. We'll break that down and give you all the details. Number two, reading between the lines. All right, we're drawing new congressional lines. We're going to redraw them. That's a given. It's going to happen. What's going to happen to where you live? What's going to happen to the ability for Republicans to still maintain a majority in our congressional delegation? What does this do, by the way, to the overall picture in D.C. with such a slim majority in the House? It's an amazing thing to think that Alabama's district lines could be redrawn and suddenly affect the ability to maintain a majority. And then number three, I'm just calling it madness. Listen, y'all, every once in a while things happen, and they happen in a way that you look at it and go, that's just freaking madness. And that's where we are with some of what happened over the last few days. Decisions made by some government offices, and then the one that kicks it off, though, it's too big for woke world. It's not funny. It's a group of LGBTQ activists openly stating they want our kids. We're going to talk about it in number three of the Triple Dipper. I'm calling it madness. All right. But in that vein, let me jump over to my comments for the day. So I got to be honest with you. I think more than anything right now, more than ever before, we need giant killers. Giant killers. We need people who can stand and make direct eye contact with giants. There's a rabid sense of desperation right now coming from the darkest places in our society. Just yesterday, in a report that I'm going to cover in more detail later in the show, marchers in a so-called pride parade in New York City marched while chanting, here's their chant, you ready? We're here, we're queer, and we want your kids. Y'all, that's just nothing but evil showing itself. Meanwhile, on our southern border, desperate ranchers in small towns are being crushed by an overwhelming tide of illegal immigrants. Major cities, especially in California, are facing an epidemic of drugs, crime, and homeless encampments that are literally squeezing the life out of once vibrant downtown areas. Now, I could go on, but you already know. There's a desperate wind blowing as if the enemies of the good are scratching and clawing to get more and more from us. Well, this great nation, to include the state of Alabama, is facing a series of challenges right now unlike any that we've had in contemporary memory. There will always be flares of social upheaval. The process of give and take and social norms or questions of fiscal discipline, wars and rumors of wars, but it is not often that we see and feel such tangible calls for societal evolution. This is a cause greater than all of us. But I want to point out something, though. This time that we're in, this craziness, this like seeming madness, this rabidness, it's really not unique in human history. We can get through this, but we will have to take out some giants first. I believe that America is poised to step into a moment right now that will set the standard for generations to come, whether to accept or hopefully to refuse to accept a new normal, one in which civil liberties, assembly, speech, due process, a right to confront our accusers, the right to ensure our votes count, actual civil liberties, where all of it could go away unless we do something. The debate rages and there's ideas, opinions, and plans from all sides of the spectrum. In the middle of it all, you may be asking yourself, how can I possibly make a difference? Can one person really do anything meaningful? What can I, in my limited sphere of influence, ever hope to accomplish? What is happening right now is giant in its scope, so my question is, are you prepared to be a giant killer? Good people who speak up and decide to take action, even by themselves or in small numbers, have often turned the tide of great moments in societies throughout history. And I got to tell you, I feel like I have to, using that analogy, I have to lean back on two of my favorite stories from the Bible. Regardless of anyone else's personal views, I believe that the storyline originating in Numbers 13 has direct application to our current crisis. Here's the deal, just for context. In that storyline, the Israelites had just come through all their years of slavery, the great exodus out of Egypt. They stood on the border of the Promised Land, and they sent 12 men over the border to check things out. And those 12 men, those spies, they got over there, and everything they had dreamed of in their quest for a new life was there. They called it the land flowing with milk and honey. A people that had been through so much were on the edge of a new life. But there was a problem. There were giants in the land, ready to oppose their progress. It was supposed to be easy, they thought. It was supposed to be a new day. No one said anything about having to overcome enemies like that. So Moses, he sent these 12 spies, and they returned with their report, of which 10 of those 12 said it was just not doable. Can't make it work. These are giants. They are insurmountable. But two men, two of them, Joshua and Caleb, they stood up and they called on the people to stay the course. But fear took over. The easy route was chosen. And the people of Israel, as a result, wandered in the wilderness for the next 40 years. An entire generation passed away before the Israelites returned to cross the Jordan and enter the Promised Land. And here's the thing. When they did finally cross over, they still had to fight. It was not any easier because they had waited. They had simply delayed the inevitable fight, and they had deferred the hard work to their children and grandchildren. I hope you caught that part. Fear of the giants led to them wandering in the wilderness, and the next generation had to come back and fight the same giants anyway. But you've all heard the story about another fight just a few generations later. David, the least among his family of the least among the tribes, he took issue with the fear and the fecklessness of the Israelite army when they were being taunted by a giant warrior named Goliath. And you all know the story about David. He slew the giant, right? But there were a few aspects of that story that perhaps you've never noticed. We're told in 1 Samuel 17 that on the way down to the fight, David stopped by a dry creek bed. He picked up 5 smooth stones. He killed Goliath with one of them. But he was mentally prepared, apparently, to stay in the fight and sling all 5 stones if one was not enough. But there's another key point in that storyline that a lot of folks overlook. You see, David was actually being mocked and spurned by his own brother for daring to think that he could fight the giant. The king told him he was too small. naysayers who could not even imagine the idea of confronting a giant, David responded with this one phrase. He said, "Is there not a cause?" Meaning, isn't there something bigger here? So is there not a cause? What a great question. I mean, a history, a way of life worth fighting for, something bigger than ourselves. I don't care where you draw your inspiration from. It can be a famous movie or a personal story or an experience of others or of your own, or in this case, from a biblical narrative. But the fact remains that we must have the social and political will to stand, or we will surely fall. You can stand, and maybe you will not reach the heights you're attempting, but if you remain seated, you will definitely not reach them. I believe the state of Alabama is on the cutting edge of this fight. We are poised, as what is supposed to be one of the most conservative states in the nation, to be a catalyst for substantive change and to serve as a bulwark against the absolute attempts to wreck our nation by liberals. Make no mistake, there are giants in our land. But I was not selected to find the easy way out, and in my opinion, sitting idle is the option of fools and cowards. It is possible to find simple solutions to hard problems. And I know who I'm talking to. This is an audience full of giant killers. Having come this far, we have to continue and cross over, or it will all been for naught. There was a scene in the Mel Gibson movie, The Patriot. Good movie. A movie loosely based on the real-life character of Francis Marion, who they call the Swamp Fox during the American Revolution. He had initially been opposed to fighting the British. But later in the movie, he was lamenting the fact that he had delayed to take action. And he was told by the female lead character, "You have done nothing for which you should be ashamed." To which Gibson's character responded, "I have done nothing, and for that I am ashamed." So here's the deal, something I say often in this show. I say it all the time. Find your place. Find your voice. Find one or two others. Go speak at a public hearing. Organize a social media campaign. Start your own podcast. Support a strong candidate for office. Run for office yourself. Write a letter to the editor. Any one of those things is good. This is our country. We are called to be good stewards of it. And by the way, it's a broad-based strategy of stewardship, and it's not easy by any means, but it is certainly doable. Because these giants we're facing right now, these social and cultural giants, they are not insurmountable. We are not the kind to turn back, and the world needs us to be giant killers. And that's a wrap for the Right Side Way. There you have it. I'm telling you, man, there are giants. It feels too big sometimes. You look at it and think, what can I possibly do? What can I possibly do? You may be surprised. Tell you what, when we get back, I'm going to tell you another story. Phil Williams, Right Side Radio. Y'all stay tuned. We'll be right back. And we are back. Phil Williams, Right Side Radio, solid conservative and just plain right. Saving the world one soundbite at a time. I got a number of text lines are open, by the way, 833-687-4448. That's 833-68-RIGHT. Several texts are already in. John from Huntsville says, Phil the Giant Killer, I loved your monologue. Also, one time I heard a story on TV about a man who picked up one of thousands of starfish and put it back in the ocean, and a man came up to me and said, do you really think that made a difference? He responded, for that one it did. That's a good story. Missy from Falkville, great monologue. While waiting tables during the Obama years, I would discuss with a veteran things the administration was doing. His response was always the same. There's too many Patriot veterans out here. He won't get away with it. But he always did. At what point are Americans going to get fed up and take a stand? We are no different from wandering for 40 years. A 40-year Israeli. What he's trying to say is we're just like we're wandering Israelis. So I got to make sure we're clear, Missy. I mean, I'm not talking about armed insurrection here, but the reality is we have got to start taking a more adequate stand against the pushes by the ardent progressive left that are determined to take away everything that we know, understand, and believe in, and just institute an entire new cultural norm. And it's going to take people just being fed up, running for office, filing lawsuits, doing what it takes, going to school board meetings, and I mean like getting busy. And there's some great examples right now. Just the other day, we had a representative from Moms for Liberty on. That started off with two moms in Florida. They now have chapters in almost every state, and they're like rocking people's world. So it can happen. It can happen. Allie from Athens says, giant killers. She said, and I've always enjoyed the fact that it's traditionally believed that David was not a very big person. That warms my heart, seeing as how I don't even hit 5'2" anymore. Anyway, all right. And then Jeremy from Huntsville says, David got 5 stones. He knew Goliath had 4 brothers. We have no proof of this. All right. Hey, listen, so talking about one man making a difference. So I had a unique opportunity a few years ago. Was at a small conference for Club for Growth. I was a Club for Growth Foundation Fellow, is what they call them. I was in the inaugural class of fellows, and so we had a gathering in D.C. and it was very cool. Got to meet some great people. They brought in big name speakers, and it was certainly enjoyable. One of those that was most interesting to me was when Mark Meadows came and spoke to us. And I'm talking about, we're just in a room with about, you know, there's about 35 of us, and there's the former chief of staff, you know, to the president. Mark Meadows, before that, if you recall, before he worked for Trump, he had been in the House as a member of the Freedom Caucus. Meadows told this story, and his point was, yes, one person can make a difference. In this case, what happened was, he heard that Trump was interested in tax cuts, and the Freedom Caucus was all for it. He said, I started writing out what we thought we could see and achieve. I thought we had the votes for this, this, and this. He said, then I sent it to Jim Jordan. He said, I'm told that Jim Jordan was like revising it on the hood of his truck in a Walmart parking lot while he was back at home. And he got his, you know, input back to me. I had it typed up, and I sent it over to Trump's office. He said, the next thing I know, I get a call from what had formerly been the chief of staff for President Trump. Said, the president would like to see you. When? Right now. Oh. And so he did what he could to get over there. And he got to the White House, and he was sitting outside of the Oval Office. And the chief came out and said, come on in. Right now? Yeah, right now. He walked in. He said, the entire cabinet was in there. He says, I'm looking. There's the vice president. There's the treasury secretary. There's, you know, he's got half the cabinet with him. And Trump's going through this thing, and he's got the memo from Mark Meadows and Jim Jordan. Now, keep in mind, two guys elected to Congress out of hundreds that serve in Congress. Are they making a difference? Apparently, because Trump's now reading their memo. And Trump's looking at his Treasury Secretary and goes, Meadows says we can do this and this. What do you think? Well, sir, I think we shouldn't cut it quite that far. Nah, what do you think, Meadows? I'd do it if I were you. Do it. Let's go ahead and put it down. The bottom line is that memo that they did, which Jim Jordan added his input into on the hood of his truck, it became the Trump tax cuts. And afterwards, Trump signed the memo and handed it back to him with the words, you know, good job written on it. And he's got it framed in his office to this day. Proof positive, he said, that you can provide input and actually make a difference. All right, folks, Phil Williams, Right Side Radio. You guys stay tuned. We'll be right back. Hey, all you Right Side ruffians out there, you are listening to Right Side Radio, solid conservative, just plain right. And we are back. Phil Williams, Right Side Radio, solid conservative, just plain right, covering down on some major ground across the northern half of the most beautiful state in the nation. I'm talking about Alabama. I'm talking about this show sends its signal like way on down south of Birmingham and up north of Huntsville and Tuscaloosa, back over to Gadsden, parts of Georgia, Tennessee, and Mississippi, thrown in just for good measure. Hey, first one on the Triple Dipper, I'm calling it Russian roulette, which is a bit of a euphemism, but the reality is Russian roulette's a dangerous game, and what we saw this past weekend was dangerous times, man. So if you're, I'm going to catch you up to speed. Some of it, if you're news hounds, this is what you've been seeing for the last couple of days. But I want to break it down to the low levels and then work our way back up to strategic levels. So just to give you the backstory, there's a guy named Yevgeny Prigozhin. Yevgeny Prigozhin, and I've got a piece here from Daily Wire that helps with his background. But Yevgeny Prigozhin has been a friend or a confidant of Putin for years. He served time in prison, almost a decade, really, for assault and robbery and fraud back in the 80s. He got out and began to work in restaurants, started his own catering business, and lo and behold, the catering business got friendly with the Kremlin. The catering business became the chief caterer to the Kremlin. And then eventually, he began to form this thing, which is now known as the Wagner Group. The Wagner Group has become Putin's mercenary army. And when I say a mercenary army, I'm not talking about like something you might go, well, Phil, don't we have civilian contractors that carry arms into, yeah, and they carry arms like, you know, small arms and basic weapon systems. And they do things like, you know, guarding facilities and you know, targeting key locations. Not like this. Most recently, the Wagner Group has been in charge of an entire sector of the Ukraine war, the Bakhmut area, where the fighting has been devastating. And I don't mean like a little bit devastating. I mean, I'm talking about like World War I trench warfare on an epic scale, devastating. The Wagner Group is said to have lost 20,000 men just in that section of the country alone. Can you imagine? You look back at the entire 20 years we spent in Afghanistan, I want to say we had something like 12 to 13,000 casualties, if I'm not mistaken. I'm not minimizing that at all. What I'm saying is imagine one small sector in 1 year and one group called the Wagner Group loses 20,000. These are mercenaries paid under contract through the Wagner Group. They're not part of the Russian army, and yet they have tanks, artillery, armored vehicles, logistical supply trains. They have everything it takes to be their own separate division. And they are getting uncontrollable. So Yevgeny Prigozhin formed the Wagner Group after being a caterer to the Kremlin, got some seed money, hired a few guys, began working and building up. Stories are that the Wagner Group is accused of massacring and raping civilians in Africa, exploiting natural resources in other poor countries, resources like gold, oil, and gas, which all go back to the Russian government with deniability because they're not technically Russian army. They operate in South America, Africa, the Middle East, Asia, Europe. The Wall Street Journal says its investigative reporters have identified 64 companies that are linked to Wagner that serve as fronts to move money and assets back to the Kremlin. And hundreds of Wagner troops faced off against U.S. forces in Syria during the Trump administration, and we whacked them. I'm talking about decimated them, killed a bunch of them. They're not overly trained. In fact, a lot of them are being conscripted right out of prisons, offered a chance for freedom if they'll come fight for Wagner, and they'll take it. So the Russian government has allowed Wagner to grow and to grow and to grow. I heard this morning, I think it was Condoleezza Rice was discussing this and said that what's basically happened is Dr. Frankenstein created the Frankenstein monster and the Frankenstein monster turned on the doctor. And that's what happened this past weekend. This guy, Yevgeny Prigozhin, is mad because he's finding out that senior leadership in the Russian army doesn't like him. He's finding out that senior leadership in the Russian army is offering to let his conscripts, his Wagner soldiers, become actual soldiers in the Russian army, thereby losing his, you know, his dollar signs. I mean, he's made billions being a thug for Putin. So what did he do this past weekend? He took his troops, left the battlefield, and started a road march to Moscow. Now, this is a 12-hour road march. But he, and for those of y'all that don't know, when you're moving mass troops across an area, if you're going in with the intent to, you know, fight your way through, you wind up keeping your vehicles completely manned and ready. Otherwise, what you might do is railhead them, or at the very least, over the roads hauling, using freight haulers to haul your tanks and things to save the wear and tear on the roads, and by the way, the wear and tear on the tanks and the armored vehicles. No. Not in this case. There was no railheading. There was no movement overland in any other way except for a fighting posture. He took, this is where it gets really wild. So there's a city just across the border called Rostov-on-Don. Rostov-on-Don was the center of military command and control for the Russian army for the Ukraine fight. The Wagner troops rolled in and took over Rostov-on-Don. And they were treated as heroes by the people there. So this is not looking good for Putin, right? 25,000 troops are now marching towards the capital, fully armed, coming off the battlefield with the intent to fight. While they're marching, it gets worse for Putin, because attack helicopters began to circle the area and come after the Wagner troops who are moving down the road. Wagner troops, using surface-to-air missiles apparently, took out 7 Russian aircraft. It was the biggest one-day loss of Russian aircraft in the entire war, and I've been told it's the biggest one-day loss of Russian aircraft since the war in Afghanistan for Soviet Union. I mean, this is big doings, y'all. They're literally fighting their way through to Moscow. A 12-hour road march, they stop at about the 10-hour mark. Stop cold. And what we're told is that the Belarusian president, and if you're looking at a map, just picture, there's Ukraine, and it's like, let's say it's like the state of Arizona. Right up there above it to the right is Oklahoma. Just below that is Texas. Picture that. That's like Texas is Russia, Arizona is Ukraine, Oklahoma is Belarus. Belarus is like a puppet of Russia, but the Belarusian president's a guy named Lukashenko. And rather than Putin getting out there and doing something, rather than the Russian army posing a fight for the Wagner troops, the Belarusian president is claimed to have brokered a deal between Wagner and Russia. Keep in mind, 3 days before, Wagner was fighting for Russia. Y'all, this is, can you imagine an army of 25,000 fully armed, armored vehicles, tanks, all of it, rolling up the interstate towards Washington, D.C.? And they're not coming from a foreign country. They're ours. It's as if Fort Benning, Georgia got mad and decided to send the 3rd Infantry Division north to D.C. That's what this is like. Roughly the distance and the capabilities. You got hardened fighters coming off the battlefield, loading up, rolling out their tanks, trucks, and equipment, and headed to Moscow. Keep in mind, Moscow is the capital of a nuclear nation. Now you start thinking about all these movies. How many movies have we had over the years? I mean, you've got The Hunt for Red October, Crimson Tide with Denzel Washington, and that was a great one, as a matter of fact. Crimson Tide with Denzel Washington and Gene Hackman. The whole backstory on that was that there was a rogue element within the Soviet Union that decided to seize nuclear assets, and they were being forced to decide whether they were supposed to respond or not. What happens if Wagner, with 25,000 armed forces, gets anywhere close to a nuclear site? What do we do? So right now, NATO is staring down this thing going, what in God's name just happened? They just pulled off the battlefield. They're marching to Moscow. Not only that, holy crap. And so I'm going to tell you right now, I guarantee you there's contingency plans that were being pulled off a shelf and dusted off. What does NATO do? We're trying to stay boots on the ground out of that war, right? What do we do if suddenly it looks like nuclear weapons could fall into the wrong hands? Do we offer Russia a chance to let us come in and help? Do we take them out ourselves with, you know, Tomahawk missiles from afar? Do we mass U.S. troops on the border against Russia to make sure they can't march back? What do we do with this? And oh, by the way, Biden's in charge. All right, listen, I'm going to break this down in more detail. We just had, literally while I'm speaking to you, Putin came out and gave his first full statement to the press. And I'll see if I can gather up some of that. But what he's basically saying is these were criminal acts, and they will not be allowed to stand. All right, let's take a break, Boom. We'll do that right now. I'll come right back. We're in number one of the Triple Dipper, Russian Roulette. Coming up top of the hour, Major General Joe Arbuckle will be on here to give us his thoughts as a military strategic planner. Bill Williams, Right Side Radio. Y'all stay tuned. We'll be right back. We'll be right back. And we are back. Phil Williams, Right Side Radio. Solid conservative, just plain right. Coming up top of the hour, we'll be having a conversation about Russia and the situation with Wagner Group with retired two-star General Joe Arbuckle, who had a long career, which included a pretty strong stint in national-level strategic planning. So, yeah, we'll get his thoughts and perspectives on all this. Let me jump back in, though. I'm calling number one of the Triple Dipper, Russian Roulette. This is no small thing, y'all. I mean, this was a brewing ugly situation. Article here from 1945.com. What happens to Russia's nuclear weapons if a civil war breaks out? And it points out the fact that with 25,000 soldiers of fortune marching on Moscow, we had an evident breakdown in civil order, conjured up the specter that nuclear weapons, it says, or more likely materials even, useful for making nuclear radiological weapons, might come under the control of rebel, insurgent, or terrorist forces. It says nuclear weapon states now come in many shapes and sizes, and but yet one of them has always been Russia. Russia has more nukes than any other nation on the face of the earth. And when you consider the strength of what the Wagner was taking down the road, the Wagner Group, you have to look at it and go, that's formidable. If they decided to turn to their east and roll in on a nuclear site, could we have stopped them? Could Russia have stopped them? Now, Putin was just on a moment ago, and his comments were basically, this suppression would have been shut down if they had not turned back on their own. Okay, bold words, Cotton, but the reality is this was big doings. This was not going to be a small fight. This was going to be people who were going to be whining. If they were willing to follow Yevgeny Prigozhin against the capital of Moscow, you got to know that they had their game on. Here's a piece, though, that people are speculating. House Intel Chairman Mike Turner, congressman from Ohio, he said on Sunday during one of the talk shows that he believes that Yevgeny Prigozhin had multiple accomplices inside of Russia to help him pull off his feet of moving his forces from Ukraine to just a couple hours away from Moscow. He says, then entering Moscow, I mean, this is, by the way, he got to, it's like getting into downtown Birmingham with Target being Huntsville. You were that close. That's how close it was. This was, in the grand scheme of maneuver, they were pressing in. And then entering into Moscow, it says, entering into Russia itself, taking their convoy to Moscow, that really shows to the basic issue of whether or not Putin controls his own military. For any government to have stability, said the congressman, they have to control their military. Obviously, Prigozhin, in order to make it that distance, has to have accomplices. Well, one of the things that I heard General Jack Keane say over the weekend was he looks at it and believes that his sources are telling him, he said, that Prigozhin believed that he had the backing of a number of senior military leaders who were going to come out in favor of his, you know, his fight and maybe even join him in the process. That did not happen. I think he saw the handwriting on the wall, basically, and recognized that he had just put himself, committed himself to a fight that he may not have any chance of taking, you know, all the way through. Secretary of State Antony Blinken in the Daily Wire says the Wagner Group's uprising revealed a weakness in the Russian regime. Going on all the talk shows on Sunday, Blinken's comments were, I think you've seen cracks emerge that weren't there before. Prigozhin himself in this entire incident, he says, has raised profound questions about the very premises for Russia's aggression against Ukraine. So basically, here's what's happened. Another thing that's going on here. Prigozhin goes in saying, you pay me big money, I'll take my men, we will fight and we will win. He's been hemorrhaging men, just getting waxed. And then on top of all that, he begins to think, I guess, to himself, and then he begins to announce to the whole world his dissent with what's happening. This war should never have happened, he says. This war is a farce. There was all this talk about how we were going over there to denazify Ukraine or to try and liberate oppressed Russian citizens, and none of it was true. And he's saying all this on the world stage. Meanwhile, he's getting paid billions of rubles by Moscow. And so the tension is rising on all of this. Prigozhin claims that Russian military leaders also targeted his own men, that they laid landmines on his escape routes from the battlefield, and that they also targeted, most recently, they rocketed one of his headquarters. He says, there's been no external verification, but he says, and so in his words, he's had enough. And he leaves the battlefield and he heads out to Moscow. Now, the Wall Street Journal did a pretty epic job of covering this over the weekend. And I've got a stack of stuff here. But I cannot, in my mind, this is one of the biggest things that I have seen in the world stage in maybe ever. I mean, this is like something out of a movie. I mean, what was that old Chuck Norris movie where the mercenary army invaded New York? Well, do you remember that movie? It was like, it may have been called Invasion USA. I think it was. It was Invasion USA. I mean, can you imagine a freaking mercenary army? Tanks, armored personnel carriers, trucks. They've got supply trains. They're marching down the road. You got the 3rd ID marching up from Fort Stewart to daggum Washington, D.C. That's what this is like. The whereabouts right now, so bottom line, too, Yevgeny Prigozhin, the head of the Wagner Group, is now missing. We don't know where he is. He's still alive. Did you find it? You're nodding your head.
Invasion USA.
Chuck Norris?
Yes, Chuck Norris.
One man took out a mercenary army trying to take over New York City.
The poster with the guns out blazing.
It's a whole other story. So Prigozhin's now missing. Lukashenko from Belarus allegedly negotiated the opportunity for Prigozhin to depart the scene and fly to Belarus. We don't know if he's there or not. The Biden administration said just before the show, they don't know if he's there or not. Nobody knows where he is. He did release an audio statement today, but there's no proof of life, so to speak, other than his audio statement. That being said, his whereabouts being unknown, the fact is he left the battlefield. Something flipped a switch. Something said all this hubris, all this smack talk, all of this 25,000 troops that I'm marching to Moscow, something made it come to a grinding halt. What do we have? I mean, can you imagine what a guy like that, the goods he has on Putin, tucked away in a special safe somewhere with directions to open it upon his death? I'm going to tell you right now, he better hire a soup tester, but I guarantee you he's got some goods on Putin. All right, listen, we're going to come back in a minute and talk to Major General Joe Arbuckle, retired now, but spent a lot of years as a strategic planner. I want to get his thoughts on this. What level of planning are we looking at? What kind of contingency ops has the United States got to consider in a situation like this? Phil Williams, Right Side Radio. We'll be right back. Side ruffians out there, you are listening to Right Side Radio, solid conservative, just plain right.
One minute.
Listening live to Right Side Radio with Phil Williams. It's hard to go wrong when you're on the right side. Right Side Radio, solid, conservative, and just plain right.
Alabama's syndicated news talk leader, Right Side Radio. Phil Williams here live in the Right Side studios. Man, we got the local, the state, the national, yep, and the international covering down on all the issues. Solid conservative and just plain right. All right, well, listen, we're in number one of the Triple Dipper. I'm calling this whole section of the show Russian Roulette. I mean, we've had the most dynamic, fluid, and kind of freakishly interesting situation over the last few days as any I've ever seen. On the world stage. I mean, the very idea that a division-level group of mercenaries, of all things, with tanks and armored vehicles, trucks and supply trains, decide to leave the battlefield in Ukraine and just go north towards Moscow with intent to do harm. Take out 7 Russian aircraft en route and then just stop. And everybody's like, what just happened? Well, keep in mind also, this is a nuclear nation. Makes it even more dynamic and more interesting. Someone coming on the show right now to lend his perspective, Major General Joe Arbuckle, retired 2-star, has been on the show several times. Not only did he have a long career in the military starting in 1969 as a private, retiring 32 years later with 2 stars, but during his tenure in service, he spent roughly the last 10 years on duty as an Army strategist, focusing on national-level strategy and logistics. And I thought, you know what, once again, let me reach out and see if General Arbuckle would want to provide some strategic level planning considerations and things that might be going on at the National Command Authority. Without further ado, let me welcome him back. General Arbuckle, how are you, sir?
Hey, I'm doing well, Colonel Phil. How about yourself?
I'm good, sir. I'm good. Thanks for asking. Hey, thanks for making time today. I got to ask you, first of all, have you been tracking all this stuff in Russia over the last few days? Because it has been highly unusual, to say the least.
You're absolutely right about that. Yes, I have been, and we're picking up bits and pieces in an unfolding situation, as you well know. And so a lot about what we hear right now in the news media and read about on articles is speculation. We do know some facts involved with the situation, however. So right now, all of us are trying to piece together what is reality. And that's a difficult thing to do in a moving situation like this.
Oh, absolutely. But what we do know, though, is that we definitely had a situation with what amounts to a mercenary army, a division-level mercenary army with armored vehicles and all, deciding it was going to go ahead and just head towards their own nation's capital. And I got to ask you, sir, when we look at that with your experience at the strategic level, when we look at stuff like that, what do you think the U.S. planners were having to go through over the last weekend as they monitored this?
Well, there would have been, number one, some level of the National Security Council that would have been convened. And related to that, I heard a report today, of course, don't know if it's true or not, but I hope it is, and I would think so, that our own intelligence agencies learned around 10 June that Prigozhin was planning some sort of a coup. And so, assuming that's correct, our intel agencies had a heads up about 2 weeks ago that something like this was going to happen. And so, at that point, as I said, elements of the National Security Council convened, including the intelligence networks, Secretary of Defense, certainly Secretary of State representatives, and then they start going through the options. What are the contingencies here? What if Gosin actually gets into Moscow's worst case? What if he doesn't? What can happen there? And so the options are put on the table, and courses of action are developed around those particular options. So that's what they've been going through. But Phil, let me change the subject real quick to you. There's something that really is a mystery to me, and I've not heard it talked about much, and that is, knowing Putin's background, he's a KGB thug. We all know that. He's ruthless. He kills anybody that gets in his way or puts him in prison for life. And he also has a pretty good personal intelligence network. And I assume, and I think correctly, he had to have spies within the Wagner group to let him know what's going on with the leadership there. And I would assume that Putin knew to a pretty large degree what Shokin was up to. Now, if that's the case, then the question arises, why did Putin allow this to go so far without stopping it? And I don't have an answer to that.
Yeah.
That is a mystery. And it has to do with, I think, his relationship with Prigozhin. I think you covered that earlier, as being his chef and trusting him and being on his inner circle. But there may be more to it than that. And I kind of think that is the case. And on top of that, Putin knew that his own Ministry of Defense was in conflicts with the Wagner group. And they were claiming that his Ministry of Defense was not providing the proper ammunition and other resources, causing casualties within the Wagner group. So why did Putin allow that conflict to continue? That is a key question that needs to be addressed.
Now, I agree, sir, and of course it'd be speculation on my part, but I said briefly before the top of the hour, I cannot help but wonder, knowing that Prigozhin has been inside of Putin's inner circle for so many years and probably has communiques or some type of direct evidence of Putin being complicit in some of the war crimes that Wagner has been accused of. And I'm purely speculating. I don't know this, but I can't help but wonder if he's got a special file tucked away somewhere, you know, designed to be brought out to the rest of the world in the event that Prigozhin is found dead. And so Putin's got to know that there's things that Prigozhin knows he doesn't want the rest of the world to know.
That's certainly true. That has to be a major factor in this. Yeah, another mystery is, you touched on earlier, is why did Prigozhin stop before he got to Moscow? And I think the answer to that is basically he realized he didn't have the backing that he needed within the Soviet military, particularly at the top ranks. And he may not have even had it within his own senior leadership within the Wagner group. Reports I've read is that he had pretty good support from the lower level members of his group, but not so much so at the higher level. And here's another thing to consider in this. So